Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the joint annual meeting of the Council of State Archivists and the Society of American Archivists. Please be seated.
I'm the 2009 host committee chair, Brenda Gunn, of the Dolph Briscoe Center for American History at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm here to welcome all of you to Austin. We're so happy to have you here. I hope that you've had a great first day and that you found your way around the hotel and the surrounding areas. And I want to thank you for two things. One, for coming to the meeting and making it a success. And here we are at the end of the first day, and I'm ready to declare it a success. From the get-go, when SAA signed the contract way back several years ago to have the meeting here, we all knew that you would come to Austin. But I'll admit there was a low period around June when we were feeling kind of bad. We were sweating bullets at the registration numbers. And you probably, if you think back to when all of those reminder emails were coming into your inbox, that's the point at which we weren't feeling so good. But it all turned around, and we hit this 1,150 number, I think, at the end of pre-registration, so we felt pretty good. So we're very pleased at the turnout. The second thing I want to thank you for is the rain. We haven't had rain all summer. Yesterday, somebody, I don't know who it was, brought the rain with them, and I want to thank you for that. Pardon? Arkansas. And if you haven't heard, we set a record yesterday. So for August 12th, we beat the record rainfall, which was 1.1 inches. So, and it kept the temperature below 100 today. So now you won't have to tweet. Now you won't have to tweet home about how people are frying eggs on the sidewalk here. So I think we're off to a fantastic start. And now, if you'll please join me in welcoming the 2008-2009 president of the Society of American Archivists, Frank Bowles.
Okay, I resign now. The hell with it. Just for me. Well, I was about to make some bad jokes about the heat, but after that, I think the host committee has set me straight. One more bad comment, and I'm gone. So thank you all so much for attending this joint annual meeting in beautiful and sizzling Austin. The first plenary session will be led by COSA President David Howery, but first we'd like to stand on ceremony for just a few minutes. As we've come to understand, it takes a posse to put on a meeting like this one. I can't say that word right. I'm sorry. I'm from the wrong part of the country. But I'd like to introduce some of that posse that made this all possible today. The 2009 Program Committee, co-chaired by Amy Felker and Mark Duffy, did an outstanding job of promoting the conference theme of sustainable archives. And they were joined in the effort of putting together the education sessions by a dynamic and diverse group of individuals. I would ask each of the 2009 program committee members to stand when I read his or her name and remain standing until all can be recognized. And I'd ask all of you to please hold your recognition and your applause until they are all standing. And first, I'd like to introduce co-chair Amy Felker, there you are, Amy. Co-chair Mark Duffy of the Archives of the Episcopal Church, USA. William Coughlin of AT&T Inc., Jacqueline Ferry of the Wisconsin Historical Society, Dorothy Hazelrig of the University of South Carolina, Jeffrey Hoof of the New York State Archives, Teresa Mora, University of California, Berkeley, Chris Payton of the Columbia Theological Seminary, Ariane Ravanbach of the National Archives and Records Administration, Teresa Riley, University of Calgary, Cindy Smolovic, National Archives and Records Administration, Melanie Sturgeon, Arizona State Library, Archives and Public Records Division, Susan Vonsalis, Harvard Art Museum, and serving ex officio the co-chairs of the 2010 Joint Annual Meeting in Washington, D.C., Jelaine Chubb and Ben Primer. Please join me in thanking our 2009 Program Committee for their outstanding efforts. From my own perspective, the 2009 host committee had a fairly interesting job. What could give a committee more license than a city whose motto is, "Keep Austin weird"? Brenda Gunn and her host committee worked very hard and did a fantastic job preparing articles for Archival Outlook to remind us of the city's history, compiled interesting repository tours, developed the Austin is for Archivists blog, and prepared for the conference a website with lots and lots of information about the area so that you could plan to make the most of your time here. But of course, you'll all be spending it in session, so. I would ask each of the 2009 host committee member to stand when I read her or his name, and please remain standing until all can be recognized. And again, I ask all of you to hold your applause until they're all standing. And let me start with Chair Brenda Gunn, of the Dolph Briscoe Center for American History, University of Texas at Austin. Daniel Alonzo of the Austin History Center. The problem with the host committees are often doing work when we do this. Ellen Kuniuki Brown of Baylor University. Stephen Cooper, University of Texas at Austin. Melinda Curley, I am sorry, Melinda. Melinda Curley, Lower Colorado River Authority. Matt Darby, University of Texas at Austin. Susan Eason, Catholic Archives of Texas. David Gracie, University of Texas at Austin. No, you can't put stickers on anybody right now. Chris LaPlante, Texas State Library Archives Commission. Stephanie Malmrose, University of Texas at Austin. Ben Rogers, Baylor University. Rebecca Romanchuk, Texas State Library and Archives Commission. Laura Sagert, Texas State Library and Archives Commission. Catherine Ann Salzman, Texas State University. Mark Shelstead, the University of Texas at San Antonio. And Susan Soy, Austin History Center. And I'd like to point out that in addition to all their other tasks, the host committee members reached out to their own institutions and, despite the economic climate, convinced many of them to provide sponsorship for the all-attendee reception, something for which we are all very grateful. Please join me in thanking the 2009 host committee for their enthusiasm and hard work. In the interest of time, David and I have decided not to introduce the distinguished members of our governing boards, our distinguished past presidents, or as I said to one of them, even our undistinguished ones, or even our extremely distinguished staff members. And they wrote that line, extremely distinguished, so it must be true. We hope that you and they all know, however, that we value them all very, very much. But we would like to take a moment to welcome several distinguished visitors, and I'd ask you to stand when I say your name, and I'd ask us all to hold our applause until the end. First, Ian Wilson, the president of the International Council on Archives and the immediate past librarian and archivist of Canada. And from here, I can't tell if he's here or not because I've got a spotlight in my eyes. Danielle Caron, the newly named librarian and archivist of Canada. Paul Banfield, the president of the Association of Canadian Archivists, as well as Scott Godine, the immediate past president of ACA. Adrian Thomas, acting archivist of the United States. You can just wave, Adrian. Kathleen Williams, the executive director of the National Historical Publications and Records Commission, as well as Max Evans, the former executive director of NHPRC. Martin Levitt, the president of the Academy of Certified Archivists, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary in conjunction with this meeting. And Doug Robinson, the executive director of the National Association of State Chief Information Officers. Thank you all very much. We are so appreciative you're here. And the last comments I have, we would like to thank for their sponsorship of various activities throughout this conference, many of the organizations which have helped us. We thank the silver sponsor, Atlas Systems, the research forum sponsor, Ex Libris, Hollinger Metal Edge, Preservation Technologies, NARA, and our Texas Consortium, the Harry Ransom Center of UTA, the Texas State University Elkeck Library, the Whitliff Collection, the Texas State University Public History Program, the Dolph Briscoe Center for American History at UTA, the University of Texas School of Information, the University of Texas at San Antonio Library, the University of Texas Libraries, and the W.R. Pogue Library, Bullock Archive, Baylor University. We thank them all for their generosity. And now please join me in welcoming the 2008-2009 President of the Council of State Archivists and the State Archivist of Pennsylvania, David Howry.
Well, thank you, Frank. To save money, Frank and I used to share hotel rooms at SAA council meetings when we were on the council together. You can see us later for stories. On behalf of the Council of State Archivists, I would also like to welcome you to Austin for our first joint COSA meeting just with SAA. For many years, COSA has joined forces with NAGARA each summer, and in 2006, we all three were together in Washington, D.C., as we plan to be again next year. By the way, COSA is ready to be wooed as we decide with whom to meet in 2011. With NAGARA meeting in Seattle last month, we obviously don't make our choice based on the projected weather, but we do have an affinity to meet in state capitals. Over the years, many of you have likely been to numerous sessions and participated in unending discussions about how best to promote our profession and our institutions and their missions. One valuable tactic is to utilize special anniversary celebrations to draw attention to our collections and our institutions. Even those states that lost are gearing up to commemorate a certain major conflict which began about 150 years ago. We don't have much oil compared to Texas and Pennsylvania, but in 2 weeks we will be celebrating the 150th anniversary of the nation's first production oil well. These celebrations generate great opportunities for promotion for all of us. I'm afraid to say that COSA itself has failed to jump on the anniversary bandwagon in this our 20th anniversary year. Our roots date back to the creation of the State Historical Records Coordinator positions in 1979, but we organized and passed our first bylaws in 1989. Of course, we will have another chance in 5 short years, and as we all know, anniversaries divisible by 25 are much more important than those divisible only by 10. You'll wonder why I'm saying this. Now you'll get it. And that's why we're celebrating for the remainder of this afternoon the 75th anniversaries of the National Archives and the National Historical Publications and Records Commission. I'm curious. I was there. How many of you in the audience were also at the 50th anniversary celebration of the National Archives at the 1984 SAA meeting in Washington, D.C.? Would you stand? We were, of course, all quite young at the time. To start today's tribute to the National Archives, we have a slideshow titled A Brief History of the National Archives, narrated by Kate Slough and Frank Cordes. Kate works in the Congressional Relations Office at NARA, and Frank works for the National Archives Foundation. Many of the slides you will see today, along with much other information, can also be seen on the 75th anniversary page of the National Archives website, www.archives.gov. Deborah Wall, who is in the audience today, coordinated the 75th anniversary activities. Where's Deborah? Hi.
The National Archives is many things.
It is buildings.
It is records.
And it is people.
However, there was not always a National Archives. For nearly 145 years, our country existed without archives, without a safe haven for our nation's historical documents, and without an agency to properly care for them. In 1911, John Jameson appeared before the House Committee in support of a petition to erect a National Archive Depository where the records of the government may be concentrated, properly cared for, and preserved. Then, in 1912, Leland published an article stating, "The chief monument of the history of a nation is its archives, the preservation of which is recognized in all civilized countries as a natural and proper function of government." It was the destruction of the 1890 census in January 1921 which gave the movement the necessary momentum.
In February 1933, President Hoover laid the cornerstone for the building. Congress enacted the National Archives Act in 1934, providing for the organization of the National Archives, and in 1935, the first staff entered the Temple for History designed by John Russell Pope. They faced a Herculean task. The first archivist of the United States, Robert D.W. Connor, and his team had to carve the structure of an organization, just as the stonemasons carved Pope's vision. For years, the dedicated staff of the archives devoted their time to filling thousands of documents, preserving fragile records, working with federal agencies, and reaching out to the public and professional communities.
The National Archives was barely a year old and still reeling from the staggering influx of government records when Congress passed the Federal Register Act. Not only was the National Archives the guardian of our history, but now it was also charged with documenting the present. The act required the archivist, in conjunction with the government printing office, to gather and print all public documents. These included presidential proclamations and executive orders, documents with legal effect, and documents required to be published by an act of Congress or by regulation. Today, the Office of the Federal Register publishes 11 separate series of government publications.
With all the advancements and improvements of a flourishing agency, nothing would prepare the archives and its staff for what would come in 1941. The devastation of World War II bled deep into the country, affecting the daily lives of our citizens as well as businesses. On December 8th, President Roosevelt addressed Congress calling for a declaration of war against the Japanese Empire. Prior to World War II, the archives averaged 54,000 cubic feet of accessions per year. In the years following the war, this figure nearly tripled. The military and civilian agencies involved in World War II produced a vast quantity of historical records equaling tens of thousands of cubic feet. These records included textual documents, maps and plans, photographs, posters and other graphic works, motion pictures and sound recordings, and electronic records. It was during this time that the archives proved itself to be a crucial aid to the government and vital support for the war effort.
World War II also had a profound impact on the Federal Register. The number of documents printed jumped from 7,850 in 1941 to 18,569 in 1943. The nature of the information published changed as well. During the war, the Federal Register published price schedules, export control regulations, selective service regulations, rationing orders, and documents on alien registration. One class of documents was no longer published, summaries of contracts for manufacture of implements of war.
The National Archives also provided public access to the documents of war. Here, Major General Anthony C. McAuliffe, hero of the Battle of the Bulge, unveils German surrender documents in the Rotunda in 1945. Standing to General McAuliffe's right is Archivist Solon Buck. A few months later, General Jonathan Wainwright unveiled Japanese surrender documents. General Wainwright was held in Japanese prison camps from 1942 until his release in August 1945.
The first congressional records were transferred to the National Archives in 1946. Unlike federal records, congressional records remain the property of Congress, and the House and Senate have separate rules for public access to their records. Here, an archivist examines one of the treasures of the Center for Legislative Archives, a petition presented to Congress on two large wheels so that the members could scroll through the thousands of names of citizens who signed the petition. This petition is part of the current exhibit, Big. Transferring congressional records to the National Archives was not a foregone conclusion. Members of Congress, concerned about separation of powers issues, for a time considered building a separate congressional archives.
In 1949, the National Archives faced a devastating blow, the loss of independence. On July 1, 1949, the National Archives found itself an agency within the General Services Administration, better known as the GSA. Most of the staff saw this transition as a blow to the morale and pride of an organization that already was one of the preeminent cultural agencies of the world. They feared that the loss of independence would diminish their ability to maintain the high standards set during the first 15 years of the organization. Some of those fears would be realized as the emphasis shifted from archiving to records management. Most of the growth in staff after 1949 came with the new responsibilities for records management rather than in the archival staff. Despite the psychological jolt of this shift, the employees carried on the critical mission of protecting our nation's most important documents and even found a few moments to have fun.
Prior to the creation of the National Archives, the Charters of Freedom, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights were housed at the State Department and the Library of Congress, and even Fort Knox during the dark days of World War II. It was not until 1952 that these documents found their way to the rotunda built to honor their greatness. On December 13th, at 11:35 a.m., General Ross and the 12 special policemen arrived at the National Archives building, carried the crated documents up the steps, and formally delivered them into the custody of Archivist of the United States, Wayne Grover. 2 days later, President Truman dedicated the new display of the Charters of Freedom.
The 1950s also saw the presidential library system recognized by Congress. President Franklin D. Roosevelt donated his personal and presidential papers to the federal government in 1939, creating the first ever presidential library. He recognized that many past presidential papers and records had been lost, destroyed, sold for profit, or ruined by poor storage conditions. Roosevelt believed that presidential papers and other materials he and his staff had accumulated are an important part of our national heritage and should be accessible to the American public. In 1950, Harry S. Truman decided that he too would build a library to house his presidential papers. In 1955, Congress passed the Presidential Libraries Act, establishing a system of privately erected and federally maintained libraries. The act encouraged other presidents to donate their papers to the government and ensured the preservation of presidential materials and their availability to the American public. Between 1950 and 1990, 8 presidential libraries were created under this model. Listing them in the order they entered the system, they are Truman, Hoover, Eisenhower, Johnson, Kennedy, Ford, and Carter.
Until 1978, records created by the president or his staff while in office remained the personal property of the president and were his to take with him when he left office. In 1974, Congress passed the Presidential Materials and Recordings Act, which seized the papers and recordings of President Richard Nixon. The debate over the ownership of the Nixon papers led Congress to pass the Presidential Records Act of 1978. This act established that the presidential records are the property of the United States government. In 2005, Congress amended the Presidential Recordings and Materials Act to allow the Nixon presidential papers to be moved to California, and in 2007, the Nixon Library joined the Presidential Libraries system. After the president leaves office, the Archivist of the United States assumes custody of the records. President Reagan was the first president for whom this law applied, and his library opened in 1991. Since then, the National Archives has opened the Bush Library on the West Campus of Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas, and the Clinton Library in Little Rock, Arkansas.
As an agency within the GSA, the National Archives expanded considerably between 1950 and 1985. Immediately, the GSA delegated its records management mission to the National Archives. That put the archives into a position of a record servicing and management agency, as well as a historical archives for wartime and post-war records.
In 1950, the first Federal Records Center was opened in Brooklyn, New York, and by 1955, there were 9 more around the country as other agencies agreed to deposit their records there. Today, there are 17 Federal Records Centers housing more than 26 million cubic feet, or nearly 80 billion pages of records. 95% of these are temporary records, but they can be critical to individuals who need them. Each year, the Federal Records Centers respond to over 13 million requests for tax records, claims files for military veterans, bankruptcy court records, and even maps of national parks. Federal record centers hold records for any person who has ever served in the military, had a social security number, or applied for a passport.
In 1969, the archivists established a regional archive system to make regionally created, historically valuable federal records accessible to the public locally. Today, the National Archives has 14 regional archives throughout the country, including the recently opened facility in Kansas City, Missouri, and a state-of-the-art facility in Morrow, Georgia, near Atlanta.
The Office of the Federal Register was expanding, too. Serving as a one-stop location, whether online or in print, it was now responsible for receiving and preserving copies of laws, regulations, and other acts of Congress and the executive branch agencies.
The decade of the 1970s brought public attention, both positive and negative, to the archives, as well as some real and public changes in its role. The agency learned that it was not immune to the kind of fires that had destroyed many early documents of the new nation. The most significant and destructive of these fires occurred July 12, 1973, at the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, on the top floor of the Military Personnel Records Facility. The National Personnel Records Center had come to be part of the National Archives in an unusual way. In 1950, the Pentagon decided to consolidate all the personnel and health records of millions of former soldiers, sailors, and airmen in St. Louis, and in 1960, the Pentagon turned over management of these records to the archives. The floor where the fire occurred contained some 22 million Army and Air Force personnel folders. Overall, fewer than 4 million records were saved, either in their entirety or with as little as one identifiable document. Since then, the Personnel Records Center has had an ongoing project to reconstruct these veterans' files using information provided by the veterans themselves and through medical records on file with the Veterans Administration. In this way, staff can verify dates of service for veterans and the status of their separation from the military, information that allows veterans to prove eligibility for government benefits.
The years from 1980 to 1985 were difficult on the archives' budget, as they were for many service agencies. The archives received the deepest cut in 1982, 16% removed from the $88 million appropriation. Celebration occurred with the coming of the 50th anniversary and unveiling of a major exhibit, The Recent America, 1934 to 1984. But none of the events received more attention or praise than the passage and enactment of legislation reestablishing the National Archives as an independent agency. The sixth Archivist of the United States, Robert M. Warner, who served from 1980 to 1985, made independence the primary focus of his administration, and he finally succeeded when Congress passed S-905. The bill was signed by President Reagan on October 19, 1984.
The struggle for independence began much earlier. In 1964, a group of historians and archivists approached the First Lady, Lady Bird Johnson, to enlist her support in winning independence for the National Archives. Opposition from GSA killed that endeavor, but archivists and historians continued their efforts throughout the following 20 years. In an article written by Warner, he recalls the long struggle for independence. "This major event in the National Archives history did not just happen. It came about after the passage of a great deal of time, a huge amount of effort, and considerable pain."
With the 50th anniversary and independence behind them, the staff at the National Archives turned their attention back to what they do best, preserving the raw material for our country's history and educating the public about that mission. As the 20th century was drawing to a close, these core functions grew increasingly complex. The archives building in Washington was overflowing and had been for years. At the same time, there was little opportunity to show the public the rich treasures hidden on those shelves. The building of Archives 2 in College Park and the renovation of the historic building in Washington presented an exciting set of opportunities.
Shortly after independence, the National Archives created the Legislative Archives Division, and in 1989 renamed it the Center for Legislative Archives. Such a center had been envisioned in the post-war development of the National Archives, but those plans fell by the wayside under the General Services Administration. Congress also created an advisory committee on the records of Congress chaired by the Clerk of the House and the Secretary of the Senate to advise the Congress and the archivist on the management and preservation of the records of Congress. The Center for Legislative Archives is unique within the National Archives because the records it manages still belongs to the House and the Senate. Those records span the entire history of the nation under the Constitution and detail the interaction of elected officials with their constituents. The center staff must be prepared to return specified records to Congress within 24 hours of a request. Today, the center holds 203,000 cubic feet, or about 508 million pages of congressional records, and a rapidly expanding holding of electronic records, soon to be one of the largest electronic records collections in the National Archives.
Archives 2 was opened with great ceremony in 1994. While the dislocation from downtown was traumatic, the staff was thrilled by the new facility. Archives 2 was a state-of-the-art facility and complemented the quality of the staff. Fond memories of working at Archives 1 were dimmed by the dust of renovation. At the turn of the millennium, the National Archives started a renovation of the historic building that would signal a new presence for an institution that had endured much over its short history.
At a cost of $88 million, the historic rotunda was cleaned and modernized. Steps leading to the Constitution were removed to make the display more accessible. The display cases were redesigned so that for the first time, all four pages of the Constitution could be shown at once. The Constitution was now flanked on one side by the Declaration of Independence and by the Bill of Rights on the other. The paintings on the walls of the rotunda were taken down and cleaned. The documents were removed from their 1950s vintage encasements and cleaned, and placed in new, more protective cases. On Constitution Day 2003, the rotunda was reopened. The stacks surrounding the rotunda were removed to make space for a 9,000-square-foot permanent exhibit to explain to the public what the archives hold and why we value them. This exhibit was made possible by the Foundation for the National Archives. After the opening of the public vaults, visitors spent an average of 45 minutes in the new National Archives experience. Before the public vaults, the average visit was less than 15 minutes.
The Foundation for the National Archives also supports a renewed emphasis on the National Archives' role in civic education. The Boeing Learning Center provides a space for archives staff to help teachers learn more effective ways to use original documents in civic education and space for students to experience the thrill of learning history from the original sources.
Less dramatic, but no less important to the mission of the National Archives, was the beginning of the Electronic Records Archives in 1998. The National Archives began taking electronic records from agencies for permanent preservation in 1968. At the end of the millennium, the challenge of electronic records loomed large. The paperless office dreamed of by early advocates of personal computers never materialized. In fact, the PC increased the volume of paper produced. Nonetheless, the archivists knew that throughout the government, important information was being created and stored electronically, and the National Archives had to prepare to take in and preserve those records. Today, the Electronic Records Archives, still a work in progress, houses millions of records and manages the interaction between the National Archives and agencies to schedule records for preservations.
As in 1935, the National Archives is a work in progress. The challenge of preserving the raw materials of history remains complex, and new media add new challenges. The staff of the National Archives work with every agency of the federal government to assure that records are preserved. They work with public school teachers to make those records accessible. The staff greets the public every day to help them honor the historic documents of our past and learn about their family's personal roles in that history.
Throughout the National Archives, we see the phrase, "Democracy starts here." Behind that phrase stand the buildings, the records, and the people of the National Archives.
I'd like to thank Adrian and her staff for preparing that for us. We'd now like to move on and also pay tribute to the 75th anniversary of NHPRC. To do that, we have on the stage Conley Edwards, the State Archivist of Virginia, and immediate past president of COSA, and Lee Stout, and a past president of SAA, a recent NHPRC commission member, and of course, most important, a member of my Pennsylvania State Historical Records Advisory Board.
Oh, there we go. Frequently confounded by inanimate objects. So, thank you, David. The Council of State Archivists is especially pleased to be leading this celebration of NHPRC's 75th anniversary because of our special relationship to the Commission. Without NHPRC, there would be no Council of State Archivists. The director of each state's principal archival agency is designated as the state's historical records coordinator, who in turn manages a state historical records advisory board, or SHRAB. The SHRABs review grant proposals from their states before they are submitted to NHPRC. COSA actually began its organizational life as the Council of State Historical Records Coordinators. Today, COSA serves as a vehicle to foster communications and sharing of best practices across state lines for the benefit of state archives and all their public and private constituents. In doing that, state archivists and COSA staff work closely with NHPRC almost every day.
From its beginning 75 years ago up until today, NHPRC has played a pivotal role in the advancement of the historical and archival profession. It's impossible in a short time that we have today to enumerate all of the NHPRC's accomplishments or fully assess its impact on the growth and development of the archival profession. The Society of American Archivists has had a designated seat on the commission since 1975. I had the honor of serving as a commission member on behalf of you all from 2002 to 2008. The National Historical Publications Commission was created in the same legislation that established the National Archives in 1934. With its early efforts directed at documentary projects, it advanced an area of scholarship that began with Peter Force and Jared Sparks. The early work that the NHPC supported has evolved into the documentary editing projects that exemplify the highest standards of comprehensiveness, accuracy, and scholarship. In 1974, after vigorous lobbying by archivists nationwide, it shows we can do it, Congress added the R for records to the commission's name. The commission's scope for grant-making activities expanded to include collection and preservation of historical records held by state and local governments as well as private organizations throughout the United States. As of early this year, NHPRC has awarded more than 2,400 grants to state and local archives, colleges and universities, libraries, historical societies, and other nonprofit organizations to support both records and publications projects. In the records program alone, NHPRC has awarded more than 1,600 grants and approximately $146 million. 175 archives have been started with seed money from the commission in amounts ranging from $4,000 to $400,000. The Society of American Archivists can be proud that it is cited as the very first recipient of a grant from the newly established records program in 1976. The Society received $20,000 and produced a series of publications that I feel certain everyone here today has used at one time or another in their work. John Fleckner, Maynard Bridgeford, Sue Hulbert, Timothy Walsh, and Austin's own David Gracie, all names well known to us now, prepared the five manuals on basic archival techniques that filled a critical need for guidance of new professionals and laid a foundation for what has become a robust publications program within SAA.
You see on the screen images from many of the projects that NHPRC has supported. You also see the words of a number of our colleagues testifying to the importance of NHPRC to our profession. How has NHPRC contributed to our profession? NHPRC has contributed to the advancement of archival theory and the development of new archival practice by supporting new ways for practicing archivists to approach their work. By helping archivists meet the challenges of electronic records, and by broadening the concept of archival documentation to include underrepresented groups and by recognizing the critical support needed to preserve Native American archives. NHPRC has served its constituency in an outstanding fashion. My colleague on the COSA board, Melanie Sturgeon, is just one of many voices who cite the extraordinary commitment to service on the part of NHPRC staff. I have never worked with a federal grant funding agency that is as responsive to the archival community as NHPRC, Melanie says. The numerous telephone conferences they have set up in the last 2 years that enable grant applicants to talk to NHPRC staff and to listen to questions from their applicants is truly a beneficial service. The willingness to consider and to find innovative projects that serve a broad spectrum of repositories is exemplary. Pat Michaelis, director of the Kansas State Historical Society, provides additional testimony. NHPRC has made its money go farther and has reached more diverse audiences than most federal granting agencies. The impact on archives in Kansas is highly significant, but ultimately incalculable. Frank Meavers echoes Pat's sentiments. Suffice it to say that NHPRC has consistently exemplified for New Hampshire archivists and record keepers the most inspiring and practical leadership possible. NHPRC has shown extraordinary ingenuity and resourcefulness in improving efficiency of our operations or improving methods of work. By promoting the statewide plans, statements of priorities, and statements of broad national needs that have fostered strategic thinking about the management of historical records. And by encouraging alliances, collaborations, and strong networks within the states that advance the work of SHRABs and other active organizations of professional archivists. And NHPRC, through its staff, has gone beyond normal expectations of a government agency, and in so doing has served as an incentive to others. NHPRC staff have used their talents to spot trends, identify emerging talent, and recognize opportunities for interorganizational and cross-state collaborations. NHPRC staff have shared their expertise in innumerable meetings and discussions with colleagues. SAA has recognized their extraordinary hard work and contributions by electing 7 former NHPRC staff as fellows of the society. NHPRC is truly a little granting agency with a big impact. How many of you have been touched in some way by NHPRC? If you will, please stand and remain standing if you are a current or former NHPRC commissioner, a current or former NHPRC staff member, a current or former state coordinator or deputy coordinator. Whoa. A current or former member of a state historical records advisory board. All right. A current or former NHPRC fellow. All right. A current or former recipient of an NHPRC grant. Or you are employed by an institution that has received an NHPRC grant. As you can see, NHPRC is a very big tent, open to all comers. The only qualification to come inside is a good idea. We hope that you have received or will receive later this afternoon one of these pins, commemorative pins, honoring NHPRC's 75th anniversary. We have volunteers ready to distribute those to you. Keep it up, NHPRC, for another 75 years. Despite the frequent frustration of administration that zero at your budgets, keep it up. Take inspiration from the words of Rocky Balboa. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward, how much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Happy anniversary, NHPRC. Keep it up. Thank you.
Thank you, Conley, Lee, and Rocky, another famous Pennsylvanian. Our next speaker is Adrienne Thomas, Acting Archivist of the United States. She's served in this role since mid-December. Prior to becoming archivist, she served as the Deputy Archivist for nearly a year after working as the CFO and Assistant Archivist for Administration since 1994. This role included oversight of the archive's financial operations, security and facilities, human resources, and procurement. Perhaps her most significant recent responsibilities prior to becoming acting archivist were overseeing the construction of Archives 2 and renovations of Archives 1. As a lifelong Jayhawk, I must mention that Adrienne is a rival Cyclone, receiving her master's in American history from Iowa State University prior to beginning her National Archives career. Welcome, Adrienne.
Thank you, David. I really want to thank David and Pat Michaels and Vicki Walsh from COSA, Frank Bowles, Peter Gottlieb, and Nancy Beaumont from SAA. When I took over as acting archivist, I decided that I would ask them if they would mind if, on a monthly basis, we'd set up a conference call and we'd share ideas and support. And that has worked out so well, and I appreciate all of your support. Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you here in Austin to discuss the common challenges we all face in caring for records. I'm especially pleased that you've chosen to honor the National Archives on our 75th anniversary, and I thank you for this kind recognition. On June 19, 1934, President Roosevelt signed the act that established the National Archives of the United States, as well as the National Historical Publications Commission. Designed by architect John Russell Pope, the National Archives building in downtown Washington, D.C. was already under construction, but there was no Archivist of the United States and archive staff. A little more than a year later, the National Archives building was occupied by more than 200 employees, even though the building was still under construction. In 1936, the first records, mostly from the Veterans Administration and the U.S. Food Administration, were moved into the archives. Probably it's safe to say that NARA's persistent challenge to find enough space for records began the day that those first accession records arrived. I believe that President Roosevelt and R.D. W. Connor, the first archivist of the United States, and those first archives employees would not recognize NARA today. We've grown to a federal agency with around 3,000 employees working in facilities across the country to safeguard and provide access to more than 9 billion records of the federal government. But while we're very proud of our history at NARA, I don't want to dwell on the past. Today, I want to tell you a little of what we're doing to prepare for the future. We are currently updating our strategic plan. You may even have seen on our website a request that all of you who have an interest to provide us with comments on where we're going. The plan serves as our roadmap for achieving our long-term goals. The Government Performance and Results Act requires all federal agencies to update their strategic plans every 3 years. This update gives us a chance while we are in to reassess where we are in relation to the goals that were set in 2006. Our new plan addresses how changes in society and in the nature of records lead us to rethink the way we do business. We have developed new strategies to expand NARA's leadership in federal records management, including electronic records management. Specifically, we will place more emphasis on the following: carrying out assessments and studies of records management in federal agencies and reporting on those results, examining our statutory and regulatory frameworks to determine if they meet 21st century needs and making the changes that are necessary. working with industry and academic experts to develop automated records management solutions to meet agency business needs and NARA's requirements. Developing the reimbursable records management services agencies need to address their physical record storage and retrieval needs, as well as their electronic records needs. We are also laying out the marker as to what our job is in an electronic government. We are currently developing the Electronic Records Archives, or ERA, a system designed to preserve and provide long-term access to electronic records. Currently, we are working with our four pilot agencies on early usage of the system to include transfer, inspection, and storage of electronic records. We are also using ERA to facilitate the rapid ingest, search, and retrieval of electronic records from the Executive Office of the President from the George W. Bush administration. During the next year, we will develop the instance of ERA that will allow us to take in electronic records from the Congress and to make them available to the public under the congressional access rules. But our responsibility in regard to electronic records is not just to build ERA. It is to identify permanently valuable electronic records wherever they are, capture them, and make them available in a usable form as quickly as the law allows. And we are committed to establishing an electronic records program that does this, one that is responsive to the federal agencies that create the records, as well as to our customers who expect continuing access to our government's records, whether those records are paper or digital. I'm sure you know one of the biggest inherent challenges any archives faces is processing records in a timely manner. Archives have a processing backlog the minute they are created, and there are always people at your door clamoring for records that have not yet been processed. At NARA, we have a goal that commits us to processing 95% of our holdings to a point where researchers can have efficient access to them by 2016. And we're making pretty good progress towards that goal. In our regions, as of August 1st, 39% of our holdings had been processed. Some of the essential elements we consider when declaring that records are processed are having them identified in a master location register, having them described in the Archival Research Catalog, known as ARC, and completing a preservation risk assessment. If the regions can maintain their processing at the current rate, their backlog of unprocessed records will be eliminated by 2011. In Washington, D.C., we faced a processing backlog of nearly 1 million cubic feet of archival records that lacked sufficient intellectual control to enable efficient and effective access. We had been trying over the years to address this backlog on a part-time basis, with the staff involved also in providing reference services. But we weren't making enough progress. Reference will eat up whatever resources you have. We reallocated resources to enable full-time processing teams to function without interruption. By last October, we had eliminated 10% of the accumulated backlog and had curtailed backlog growth. We expect to eliminate another 10% by the end of this fiscal year. Another initiative being added to our strategic plan that is aimed at getting more records to people who want to use them is the establishment of the new National Declassification Center. As you may know, the President has directed that Executive Order 12958, as amended, which governs the classification and declassification of national security information, be revised to reflect the ongoing need to balance the needs of national security and the rights of citizens who have access to the records of their government. The President has directed the interagency team tasked with drafting the new executive order to include in its recommendations the establishment of a National Declassification Center in the National Archives. NARA had already begun the planning process with other federal agencies to develop the concept of operations for the center, designed to improve work processes and develop innovative policies and strategies designed to increase the flow of declassified records to the public and at the same time to protect information that must remain classified. In 2007, NARA began a voluntary interagency program known as the National Declassification Initiative, or NDI. NDI was designed to more effectively manage multi-agency equity referrals and deal with the quality assurance issues. For years, the pace of declassification has been slowed because the records have to pass through the hands of every agency that hold an equity in them. NDI brings all of the equity-holding agencies and the classified records together, which both increases security for the records and speeds the declassification process. In effect, the NDI has proven to be a prototype for many of the concepts that form the basis for the new National Declassification Center, except that agencies' participation now will be mandatory, not voluntary. The bottom line here is that we are effectively reinventing the declassification process in order to get records into the hands of the American public more quickly and efficiently. We're proud to have the responsibility of establishing the National Declassification Center, and you'll be hearing more about this in the future. One of NARA's strategic goals states that we provide prompt, easy, and secure access to our holdings anywhere, anytime. I'm sure you can imagine that realizing this goal is extremely challenging. The Internet has introduced countless researchers to the holdings of the National Archives. While we are thrilled with the desire for online information, thrilled that the desire for online information brings more and more people to our virtual doors, the task of building an archives without walls is a demanding one. An important part of our effort must be in developing means for archivists to interact with our virtual visitors. This year, we work to increase visibility and transparency of our online programs and services. We developed a web governance strategy to identify Web 2.0 technologies and social media tools that enhanced NARA's interactive, collaborative, and participative relationships with federal agencies, partners, and the public. We successfully launched the National Archives YouTube channel on June 19th, our 75th anniversary, to share videos about our programs and events. A second channel expected to launch next year will feature videos from our holdings. We piloted a blog and a Twitter site for our annual Records Administration Conference in May. And while that pilot was underway, we developed plans to implement a more robust network infrastructure to support multiple blogs, wikis, and other database back-end products. We are making progress on developing a blog called Narrations, which will offer a new question each week about research and access to our holdings. In July, we joined Flickr to share historic photos from our collections. Our photo stream features some of NARA's most popular photos, as well as Women's Bureau photographs of women in the workplace during World War II, and photographs taken as part of the DocAmerica project, sponsored by the EPA during the 1970s. On August 3rd, we launched two pages on Facebook. One page features programs and events sponsored or hosted by NARA, and the second Facebook page is targeted to researchers. I hope that you'll all become one of our fans. We also implemented a social bookmarking technology on archives.gov that allows visitors to more easily bookmark our pages to their social networking pages on Facebook, MySpace, and others, and to share a page with their friends and colleagues. Web 2.0 technologies are powerful communication tools, and I know that our recent initiatives are just the tip of the iceberg of what's yet to come in that area. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, I don't think President Roosevelt could have ever imagined the National Archives that he championed so enthusiastically 75 years ago would grow and prosper to become what it is today. I am convinced he would be very proud of everyone who has worked for the agency over the years and contributed their skills, talents, and spirit to ensure that the records of the government of the United States are safeguarded and made accessible to the American people. It strikes me that as much as things may have changed at the National Archives in the past 75 years, and as much as the archival field in general has changed, the purpose of our work and the passion and commitment with which this work is carried out has remained steadfast over the years. One thing is clear. We at NARA could not carry out our mission without the support of the greater archival community, and I thank you all for that support. Your involvement and the involvement of all of our stakeholders and partners adds invaluable expertise, depth, and richness to our programs and our initiatives. In the coming months, I look forward to introducing you to the new Archivist of the United States, Mr. David Ferriero, now awaiting Senate confirmation of his appointment. I am also looking forward to seeing everyone in Washington, D.C. at next year's conference. It's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Thank you very much.
Frank is going to return to the stage for a special presentation.
I was warned not to take the sign down twice. Adrian, on behalf of the Society of American Archivists, I'd like to present you with a resolution honoring the National Archives and Records Administration on this anniversary. And if you'll allow me, I'd like to read it to those assembled. Whereas the National Archives was founded by an act of Congress signed by Franklin D. Roosevelt on June 19, 1934, and whereas the National Archives has the critical mission of safeguarding and making available documents that have guided our history and shaped our future, including the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. And whereas the National Archives serves all Americans by keeping and making available vital records that tell the stories and document the contributions of our people, such as the military records of those who bravely served in the armed forces, naturalization records of those who brought their dreams to America, and census records enumerating the individuals and communities that make up our great nation. And whereas the Electronic Records Archive, established in 2000, is laying the foundation for preserving and providing public access to the electronic records that have become a basic record of governmental decision-making and activity, and whereas the National Archives has become an international leader among public archives, serving as a model both within the United States and internationally by advocating the importance of the rights of citizens to inspect the records of their government, and whereas the National Archives performs a number of other vital services, such as publishing the Federal Register, which provides an ongoing record of the official actions of the federal government, providing outstanding public outreach programs, and supporting archives and archivists across America through the National Historical Publications and Records Commission. And whereas the National Archives and Records Administration's 75th anniversary will be celebrated at the opening plenary session of Sustainable Archives, Austin 2009, the joint annual meeting of the Council of State Archivists and the Society of American Archivists in Austin, now therefore be it resolved that the Council of the Society of the American Archivists hereby recognizes and thanks the National Archives and Records Administration on the occasion of its 75th anniversary. Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank
you. Okay, we've done the photo op. One more time. We've done the photo op.
I would like to thank everyone here for joining us in this special celebration of the National Archives and NHPRC's 75th anniversary. You're now invited to go downstairs to the fourth floor to the governor's ballroom for the grand opening of the exhibitors hall. Thank you for being here this afternoon, and please join us downstairs.